Tune in to the Weekend World Review every Sunday, 1 p.m., bringing you up to date on the latest world news from Al Jazeera English and other independent news sources. Every Sunday, 1 p.m., Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org.
Thousands of anti-government protesters have been attempting to storm the presidential palace.
Riot people are totally outnumbered.
We're hearing loud explosions from the protesters, gunfire as well.
There's a barricade there, so we can't get through. We've been pushed through by the police!
So, three top administration officials, three separate but overlapping visits to the Middle East. Right now, the United States' commitment to the peace process is starting to look a whole lot stronger. You've got the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor, they're both on their way, but the focus right now is on this man, the Middle East envoy George Mitchell. He is currently in Israel, and we will have more on that shortly. First, Zeina Awad, though, on Mitchell's fence-mending trip to Syria.
After 4 years of isolating Damascus, there's no doubt relations with the U.S. are getting warmer.
First big bang of the day.
U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell chose to stop in Syria before going to Israel. He wants to kickstart a regional peace process, and he wants Syria to be an integral part of it.
I discussed with the president the prospects for moving forward on our goal of comprehensive peace in the region and improved bilateral relations between Syria and the United States.
Mitchell says he wants to get Syria and Israel talking again. Syria ended indirect talks with Israel during Israel's war on Gaza at the end of last year. Smiles and handshakes, but no word on tangible details.
We have no strategy yet announced by Washington about where they would see a political process evolving. And so rather than become too stuck and bogged down in a particular single issue, he is trying to, what might be described as, widen the variables, bring in the Syrian track.
This land is at the heart of the dispute between Israel and Syria. The Golan Heights, which Israel has been occupying since 1967. Syria says it wants all of its land back. Only then will it talk about its support for Hamas and Hezbollah, two groups Israel considers to be a serious threat.
If Syria cannot get on the phone and tell Hassan Nasrallah, you have to disarm tomorrow. The positive role that Syria can play towards the end of a peace process, or once the Golan or the entire deal is reached, is moderating the behavior of non-state players.
The Obama administration has gained the confidence of Syria, and the Syrian government says it wants Washington to broker any future talks. But the question here is whether the third part of this equation, Israel, is also willing to re-engage. Zeina Awad, Al Jazeera, Damascus.
So the Obama administration clearly sees Syria as a key to what it calls a truly comprehensive Arab-Israeli peace. And this is why. Have a look at the map. Hamas, first of all, in the Palestinian territories. Syria is one of its major supporters. Hezbollah in Lebanon, where Syria was an occupying force for decades and still maintains strong ties with the group. And also Iran. Syria has a relationship with the country that's called for the destruction of Israel and considers America the great Satan. George Jabr is a former Syrian member of parliament, now political analyst in Damascus, who says any change in the region will depend on Israel.
Well, the broader approach was Syria's approach to start with. It was not the American approach. We remember that back in 1977, America encouraged Sadat to go unilaterally with Israel, and that did not produce peace. The Syrian approach has always been for broader comprehensive peace. I suppose that the Americans are more serious than before in trying to find comprehensive peace in the region. But will they succeed? As a matter of fact, the obstacle has always been that Israel is there, and Israel, regarding the Golan Heights, has decided from the very beginning that the Golan Heights will not be returned in full to the Syrian sovereignty. This is something very important.
Okay, so that's Syria. Over in Israel, meanwhile, illegal settlements is one of the major issues the Obama administration says is not negotiable. Israel must stop all settlement activities in the West Bank and Jerusalem. That's where Mike Hanna sent us this report.
Israeli settlers lay claim to a vacant building in East Jerusalem. The action legal, according to Israeli courts, but opposed by those who view such activity as settlement building in occupied territory. The police on hand to enforce the court order.
Today, especially when George Mitchell is in town, settlers want to send George Mitchell a clear message that your job, your assistance, your government, your administration's political will doesn't mean anything, and they are going forward with stealing Palestinian homes, and nothing's going to stop them.
In recent days, there was a diplomatic flurry over another building in East Jerusalem, the U.S. insisting that Israel halt all plans for its residential development, in so doing calling into question the Israeli position that it has full authority over what it sees as annexed rather than occupied territory. The facts on the ground, a tangible expression that the U.S. recognizes Jerusalem as divided, regardless of Israeli claims.
The reality is that the United States maintains two consulates in the city, one in the west of Jerusalem and one here in the east. In every round of negotiations to date, the status of Jerusalem has been left until the final stage of the process, not the beginning.
George Mitchell's first meeting was with Ehud Barak, whose defense ministry oversees all activities in the occupied West Bank. No detail on specifics of what was discussed, just an assurance that the relationship remains warm.
These are discussions among friends, both personal and public. These are not disputes among adversaries. Our discussions cover a wide range of issues, all of which are intended to help promote what we share in common, a desire for comprehensive peace in the Middle East.
No comment either on Israeli media reports of a deal in the offing concerning settlements, one that could involve a temporary freeze in settlement activity after specified projects currently underway are completed. And no indication yet as to whether Mitchell intends to annex East Jerusalem to the settlement negotiations. Mike Hanna, Al Jazeera, Jerusalem.
We're going to move on to Iraq now, where early results from Saturday's elections in the Kurdish region of the country point to significant gains for a new opposition coalition. The Goran movement appears to have won most of the votes in Sulaymaniyah, which is one of three provinces under control of the Kurdish regional government. The ballots have been counted in Baghdad and official results are not expected for several days. So this apparent win by Goran in Sulaymaniyah strikes a blow for the region's long-standing political heavyweights. They are the current regional Kurdish president, Masoud Barzani, and Iraq's national president, Jalal Talabani, who is Kurdish himself. Hoda Bilhamid has more.
This vote is very symbolic. Jalal Talabani, along with Masoud Barzani, are really considered the fathers of the Kurdish region, in the sense they are the ones who led the struggle against what was perceived the oppressive regime of Saddam Hussein. They are the ones who got the autonomy for this region, and for once, it's the first time since then that they have been defied, and one of them lost.
And still in Iraq, gunmen have carried out a brazen attack on a money exchange office in the capital, shooting dead four members of staff. Police say four other people were wounded in the raid in Baghdad's Karada district. Five gunmen were involved. It's not known whether they actually made off with any money. A convoy carrying one of President Hamid Karzai's running mates for August's Afghan elections has been attacked in what his office is describing as an assassination attempt. Dozens of vehicles in Marshal Mohammad Qasim Fahim's convoy were ambushed in northern Kunduz province in a hail of bullets and rocket fire. James Bays in Kabul is following events there.
This was clearly an assassination attempt against one of the most important figures in Afghanistan's forthcoming election. Marshal Fahim is one of two of Hamid Karzai's running mates. Because of security, Hamid Karzai hasn't left Kabul yet. He hasn't been to any campaign rallies. Much of his campaigning has been done by this controversial figure, who is a former Minister of Defense. A Ministry of Interior spokesman is telling us that Marshal Fahim, who is traveling in Kunduz province in the north, was unharmed, but one of his bodyguards was injured, as was a television cameraman who was traveling with the convoy. A Taliban spokesman telling Al Jazeera that they were responsible for this ambush. James Bays, Al Jazeera, Kabul.
Over in Pakistan, authorities say they've arrested the pro-Taliban cleric Sufi Muhammad. He was arrested along with his two sons during a raid in Peshawar. Sufi Muhammad helped negotiate a peace deal between the government and the Taliban in Swat Valley back in February. The deal, which saw a stricter version of Islamic law brought into the valley, was widely seen as strengthening Taliban control in the area. And in separate developments in Swat Valley, the Pakistani army has been showing off a large cache of weapons it says were seized from the Taliban. They've also recovered vehicles and other equipment they say the Taliban looted during their occupation of Swat Valley. India's joined a select list of nuclear powers. It's just launched its first nuclear-powered submarine, becoming only the sixth country in the world capable of doing so. The 6,000-ton Arihant was built with Russian help and means India is now able to fire nuclear missiles from air, land and sea, a move likely to rattle both Pakistan and China. Pakistan's government appears to be losing its sense of humour, meanwhile. A new law on cyber traffic means texting or emailed the wrong joke to your friend could land you up to 14 years in jail. From Islamabad, Imran Khan reports.
It's said to have made life easier. Mobile phones, text messaging, email, all vital ingredients of modern life. But here in Pakistan, electronic communications have become very controversial. The country's interior minister has asked its security services to act on new legislation and monitor text messages and email traffic to combat ill-motivated and concocted messages. But the new Cybercrimes Act has not gone down well.
I think it's totally ridiculous because it's like you're entering into the privacy of any person. And it's the sentence which this says is 14 years, which is also, I mean, I have to say, it's almost like similar to the sentence if you murder someone. So sending an SMS and killing someone is not the same thing.
It looks to me as if it is against the human right. You should have some kind of privacy.
Beyond the markets, human rights activists say the law is the first step to a police state and hope the government sees sense.
It's a violation of human rights. It goes against the 1973 Constitution, which is very clear on the freedom of expression, the freedom of the media. You know, Article 19 is there for all the world to read and see. Private individuals, as long as it's not found to be treasonable, as long as one is not conspiring against the state or against the government, I think making fun of the president or the prime minister or the interior minister, they ought not to have such thin skins. And frankly, they ought not to do things which will prompt such, humorous or hilarious SMS messages.
But even within the government, the law is controversial.
Here's one potential scenario in which this law could be applied. I've just finished having coffee with a friend of mine in one of the many marketplaces that dot this city. He's told me a joke about the Pakistani president, Asif Ali Zardari. It's innocent enough, but I find it amusing, so I decide to share it with some friends. I type it into my phone and I press send. Now, if I do that, I can be liable for prosecution and also I could face 14 years in jail. The Pakistani Prime Minister, Yusuf Raza Gilani, has said that he's not going to enforce these laws, which just goes to show you just how unpopular the Cyber Crimes Act is across Pakistan. Imran Khan, Al Jazeera, Islamabad.
Security forces in Nigeria have killed more than 40 members of a heavily armed gang in pitched gun battles in the predominantly Muslim north. Around 70 members of a group called Boko Haram attacked a police station in the city of Bauchi. Security forces later arrested hundreds more gang members. Boko Haram is said to be a Taliban-inspired sect which wants Sharia or Islamic law to be imposed in all of Nigeria.
Where attitude changed.
The road at this point is blocked by these masked protesters.
Where progress is achieved.
Ban cricket is the game of sound.
Where the consequences are felt.
Another burial, another grave in family. Every day people are being murdered here.
This is Al Jazeera.
Listen to Al Jazeera news reports on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101 FM, freakradio.org, between 7:30 and 8 a.m. weekdays. Also on the weekly World Review Sundays at 1 p.m. Free Radio Santa Cruz, unlicensed independent radio since 1995.
In Australia, where foreign students are considered a boon to the country's economy, they actually bring in more than $12 billion US dollars a year. But it is an industry that thrives on the image of Australia being a safe place to study. And a recent series of attacks on Indian students means that reputation has been tarnished. Laura Kyle has more from Melbourne.
Mir Kazim Ali Khan worked hard convincing his parents to let him come to Australia. He's training in hospitality, determined to get a job in Dubai. But Khan's not found his host country as hospitable as he'd hoped.
Two guys were wearing a hood, like covering the faces with the hood, and like they gave me a very bad punch on my face and ran away from there. And I got 8 stitches around my eye, and I got a fracture on my cheekbone and nose.
It's not the first time Khan's been targeted. He's also had eggs thrown at him from a passing car. His mother is desperate for him to come home.
The first thing, like my mom was very worried about me. And she said to me that come back, no need to stay anymore, or there, come back.
Khan was the 16th reported attack on Indians in Australia in 4 weeks, and students had had enough. Protests in Melbourne and Sydney fueled a media frenzy back in India, which painted Australia as a country full of racist hatred towards Indians. Gautam Gupta helped organise the protests. He says the attacks have been going on for years and most go unreported.
There is a small minority of people in Australia that are racist, which is unfortunate, and our fight is with them.
The issue of racism is a complex one here in Australia. It's a land of immigrants, with 1 in 4 people born overseas. Hundreds of thousands come here looking for a better life, and it's particularly evident here in Melbourne, the multicultural heart of the country.
Professor Babajan says scratch below the surface and you find a very different story. She's part of a nationwide study of racism which has found 1 in 8 Australians identify themselves as overtly racist.
A particular minority group, like 12%, are the vocal hardcore. But around that is a group of people who condone and agree with those sorts of opinions but are not vocal about it.
International students bring in $12.5 billion. They're the third largest export earner for Australia.
If it was to all be taken away, we'd be devastated. It'd be like billions of dollars a year going into the sector. There'd be thousands of academic jobs lost.
The Australian government has shifted into damage control mode. Paul Evans of the Victoria Police has just returned from India, part of a delegation promoting Australia as a safe place to study. He says 85% of foreign students are happy with their time here and that the majority of attacks have been opportunistic and not racist.
There is a racial element, but that's by far the minority. And as I said, that's consistent with anywhere in the world. And probably in this country, we're probably a lot more tolerant than many other countries because of our very background. I think it's very clear, the message is very clear from the highest levels that this country does not tolerate racism in any form.
Khan says he sees more police patrols on the streets now, but he's still afraid to go out after 8 p.m.
Please don't come here, because this sort of thing's happening here. If you come here, like maybe happen with you also.
For many foreign students, scratching the surface reveals Australia's commitment to multiculturalism to be only skin deep. Laura Kyle, Al Jazeera, Melbourne, Australia.
And you're listening to the Weekend World Review. We're going to break with a track from Midnight Oil called Redneck Wonderland. Stay tuned.
Wonderland. Got you in my sights, spotlit by the fence. If you're small, you're fair game. It's just common sense. Brick and tile for miles, rolling in the aisles, rifle in my hand. Redneck Wonderland.
treatment draining from your face. Redneck Wonderland. Redneck Wonderland.
This is Ward Churchill saying, get yourself a mind transplant. Listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM.
Now, Cubans are marking their Revolution Day. 56 years ago, Fidel Castro led a rebel attack on the Moncada Army barracks in the eastern city of Santiago. That assault actually ended in failure, but Cubans still consider it the start of the Cuban Revolution. This year, celebrations taking place in Holguín, the birthplace of Fidel Castro. His brother, the current president, Raúl, addressed thousands of Cubans gathered there. But as Craig Morrow explains from Havana, the flagging economy means there's little cheer on the streets of Cuba.
These are now everyday scenes in Cuba. Shops selling imported electronics. People waiting in line to buy new mobile phones. Signs of the modest changes introduced by President Raúl Castro after he took over one of the world's most centralized economies. Here, private enterprise, Cuban style. A retired couple makes clothes, selling them out of their home. But Cuba's flirtation with open markets couldn't have come at a worse time.
This whole global crisis has hit Cuba also. Things are really bad here.
A double punch hit Cuba last year, the worldwide economic slowdown and a series of hurricanes that devastated parts of the island. Power outages have become more common. The government has clamped down on the black market, on which many Cubans depend for their shopping.
Amid this economic contraction, Cubans are set to celebrate the 26th of July, one of the most important dates in the history of the Cuban Revolution.
This year's celebrations take place in the eastern province of Holguín. Fidel Castro was born here, and it's also the region hardest hit by last year's tropical storms. It was July 26th in 1953 when the Castro brothers and their band of rebels raided the Moncada military barracks. The attack was a failure, but it's considered the launching of a socialist revolution that would change this island forever. Nowadays, everyone, from the Castro brothers on down, recognizes that the revolution needs some fine-tuning. As the economy stagnates, Cubans are becoming ever more frustrated.
I hope that our president is intelligent enough to realize that we need change. For example, those of us who don't get remittances from abroad, we should be able to open small businesses. That will only help the economy.
Until then, these stores might remain less like shops and more like high-tech museums. With 60 pesos to spend, Ana Josefa Fer can't afford the DVD player she was hoping to buy. Maybe in the future, she says. Something many Cubans are probably waiting for, too. For now, they can look, but most can't have. Craig Morrow, Al Jazeera, Havana.
Still in the Americas, the Colombian military says it's killed at least 16 FARC rebels after 2 days of fighting in the jungle. The Air Force has released video showing what it says is a rebel camp being bombed in the southern region of Meta. The raid was believed to be targeting the man known as Monojoyjoy, the military chief military commander of that guerrilla group.
You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is the Queen of Caffeine, and we're educating the masses.
The ousted Honduran president Manuel Zelaya says he's setting up camp within sight of his country's border as he continues his demands to be allowed to return home. He's in Nicaragua trying to put pressure on the interim government, which of course forced him out last month. Monica Villamizar caught up with him at the border. She sent us this report.
Back at the border, but again, no real attempt to cross back into Honduras. The ousted president drove in a long convoy of vehicles, But this display looked more like he was campaigning for supporters than really trying to get back into his country. He's surrounded by his closest friends and allies. He waves at supporters and curious Nicaraguans who've gathered to watch the drama playing out in the mountainous border region with Honduras. We caught up with President Zelaya after yet another trip to the border town of Las Manos.
We are heading to meetings with the resistance organization who are gathered along the border.
He is always checking his BlackBerry while having lunch with his two closest advisors, the ousted Foreign Minister Patricia Rodas and the Venezuelan Chief of Diplomacy Nicolas Maduro.
Do you feel that international support is diminishing right now?
De ninguna manera. Lo que pasa es que...
No, not in the least. What happened is diplomacy, and diplomacy has limits. It has several levels. We do have international backing, especially from countries close to us.
People are saying that you do not have the number of supporters that you need in order to go back into Honduras.
They have been limiting the number of people allowed across the border. My family wasn't able to cross. And if they open the border, half of Honduras will be here within 24 hours.
Zelaya bought detailed maps of the border zone and told us he would not hesitate to break into Honduran territory. But he says he also wants to move forward to find a diplomatic solution to the political crisis. Those two ideas are contradictory, a sign that Manuel Zelaya doesn't quite know what to do next. Monica Villamizar, Al Jazeera, at the border with Nicaragua.
Tuned to the Weekend World Review. My name is Skidmark Bob. I'm going to break with a song by Don Henley. I Will Not Go Quietly. Stay tuned. We got more coming up here. WBAI report on Honduras. 420 drug war news. Extreme weather. Free press media minutes. And third paradigm coming up at the top of the hour. 2 o'clock as per usual. Stay tuned. Free radio.
Thought about leaving town. I could have died if I wanted to. Slipped over the edge and drowned. But oh no, babe, I won't give up that easy, no. Too many tire tracks in the sands of time. Too many love affairs that stop on a dime. Well, oh babe, I think it's time to make some change. Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna tear it up. I'm gonna crash it up. I'm gonna round it up. I'm gonna shake it up. All of me, I will not lie down. I'm brave enough to be crazy, strong enough to be weak. Heroes with feet of clay whose mighty ships have sprung a leak. And I want you to tell me, darling, just what do you believe in now? Well, come on over here, baby, about to give me a heart attack. Wanna wrap my loving arms around the small of your back. Yeah, I wanna pull you, pull you, pull you, pull you right up close to me. Yeah. Shake it up.
you ever get lonely? Don't you ever get down? Don't you ever get tired of all the wicked tongues in this town? Ooh, baby, just wanna take you away from here. Ain't no tagging, ain't no little lamb. Suppose you tell me, mama, who do you think I am?
Before the meeting, dozens of Hondurans, Dominicans, and other Latin Americans stood outside the hall on Audubon Avenue holding signs demanding the return of President Zelaya.
My name is Cristina Wins, and I came here today to support President Zelaya from Honduras.
Are you from Honduras yourself?
No, I'm from the Dominican Republic, but we support Zelaya because we know what a dictatorship means. We have a dictatorship for more than 30 years in the Dominican Republic, and we don't want that Honduras go through this again.
Every so often in Central America, South America, the Caribbean, a dictatorship tries to take the government. What do you think this is?
Well, because the oligarchy, they don't want the poor people to get some of the benefits of the country. They want everything for themselves. But now, the people, they are not going to accept that anymore.
Jorge Diaz has been in the United States for over 20 years. He went back to visit his homeland last year.
And I saw the people, the poverty. The people of Honduras is in poverty. And we need a change, a true democracy, not democracy like when America support democracy, it's the true democracy. We need support for the people, education, for the kids, for the adults. We don't want American base. Why? We need technology, we need a laptop computer, we need help, we need hospital, we need everything, but we don't want war.
Chants of support greeted the Honduran ambassador's arrival. In his speech, he said that the Micheletti government installed by the military is increasingly isolated, but that a longer standoff may lead to bloodshed because the people of Honduras will not back down in their stand for democratic rule.
Si ese gobierno no entrega pronto el requerimiento que
if that government does not comply with the request of the United Nations, the Organization of American States, Mercosur, and the Central American Union, there can be bloodshed in Honduras. And if that occurs, the blame will be shared by those who did not take the necessary steps to overthrow an illegitimate government. A government has taken power in a brutal and obscene way, violating all democratic principles and legality. If they don't do it, the Honduran people will. This is what they want me to tell. For the WBAI Sunday News in Washington Heights, this is Fred Nguyen.
This is Attila the Stockbroker. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
www.freakradio.org, 101.1 FM, reclaiming the airwaves since 1995. Say no to corporate oral smegma.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Electrical Workers Union is blasting GE's plans to eliminate more jobs. GE plans to close more plants in a restructuring of its lighting business, despite public pronouncements from GE calling for a dramatic industrial renewal and a recommitment to U.S. manufacturing. The UE says that GE continues its long history of slashing domestic manufacturing jobs. GE's financial services arm got an $80 billion loan guarantee from the federal government, but GE continues to cut U.S. manufacturing, shifting production overseas. UE says GE's compact fluorescent lamps, for example, are made in China, and GE has given no indication that it intends to produce future lighting products like LEDs and organic light-emitting diodes in the U.S. The United Auto Workers Union Ford workforce is down now to 47,000. In 2003, it was 95,000. About 1,000 UAW Ford workers accepted company buyout offers last quarter. Ford says no more UAW buyouts are coming, though. Ford actually posted a net profit of $2.3 billion in the second quarter of this year. That profit stems from a gain in debt reduction. Could Michigan be gunning for the highest minimum wage in the country? Jesse Russell reports.
Michigan Democrats may seek a ballot initiative to increase the minimum wage in Michigan to $10 per hour. The proposal was one of a number of initiatives the party is considering to put before voters in 2010. The current minimum wage in Michigan is $7.40 per hour. 304,000 voters would need to sign on for the issue to make it onto the ballot. Other initiatives floated by the party include a proposal to require all employers in the state to provide health care, a moratorium on home foreclosures for 12 months, and an increase to unemployment benefits. The health care proposal would include all businesses regardless of size and would fine those that don't comply. A decision will be made at the end of the year whether or not the party should move forward with the proposals. Michigan currently has the highest unemployment rate in the country at 15.2%.
According to the Fiscal Policy Institute, an estimated 123,000 New Yorkers will benefit from today's federal minimum wage increase, but only slightly. They'll get 10 cents an hour more than the current New York minimum of $7.15. According to the Institute, the minimum wage is 21% below its peak real value in 1970, which in today's dollars would be $9.23 an hour.
Here is today's economic report. Home prices continue to fall throughout the country. The median price of a home was down 15% in June when compared to the same time a year ago. The median price is now $181,800. However, sales of existing homes were slightly up in June as compared to May. The National Association of Realtors reported a 3.6% increase in sales.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Our guest on the first combo hour for the Drug Truth Network tonight will be Mr. Paul Armentano of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He'll be with us live to answer my questions and yours. But here's part of a prior discussion I had with Paul. You know, Paul, over the last few years, and really since they began investigating it, they've shown top-notch scientific journals, etc., that, as we mentioned earlier, it helps fight infection. It helps those with MS, with Parkinson's, with cancer, you know, to fight the wasting, the AIDS wasting syndrome, those with spinal injuries. The list goes on and on. And yet, because the people remain silent, I want you to get folks out to that normal conference. I want to encourage folks to participate and do their part. Paul, wrap it up for us, about 30 seconds.
Sure. If people go to our website, www.norml.org, they can learn everything they need to know to register for the 37th Annual Normal Conference. They can book their flight. They can find a roommate online. They can look through the agenda. They can see who the speakers are, see who the what panels they're going to be, what social events they're going to be. This is really going to be a terrific conference. We expect to have about 500 or 600 attendees. If you care about marijuana law reform, if you care about networking with other activists, you've got to come to this conference. I can't stress it enough. The Normal Conference, you know, every year is really the conference for the marijuana activists. This year is going to be no different.
That conference will be in Smoky, San Francisco, California, September 24th through 26th. Check it out at norml.org. This is a special announcement to all Drug Truth Network listeners. Cultural Baggage has moved to Sundays at 6:30 p.m. Central Time. It will be followed immediately by Century of Lies at 7 p.m. Central, and it will feature a new segment. It's time to face the Inquisition. Here's where you come in. You get to ask your questions of the guest that I just interviewed on the Cultural Baggage Show. You get to help us face the Inquisition right there on the Century of Lies program. You can do so by listening in live at kpft.org and then calling toll-free 1-877-9-420-420. Again, that toll-free number, 1-877-9-420-420. Again, our guest tonight will be Paul Armentano of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and you can call in toll-free to 1-877-9-420-420. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Some other news in brief. Mongolia struggling to cope with the worst flooding in its capital city for more than 40 years. Heavy rains deluged Ulaanbaatar and surrounding areas on the 17th of July. That killed 24 people, and there has been little let up since. Recent downpours and hailstorms have caused more flash flooding, hampering relief operations. The International Red Cross has drawn more than $200,000 from its emergency fund to provide food, clothing, and blankets. South Korea now, where five workers were killed when a large steel frame collapsed at a construction site. Nine other workers were injured in the incident near Seoul. The frame was part of a bridge that was being built for a light rail system. And a teenage monk has been ordained as the 11th Panchen Lama, a position considered the most important in Tibetan Buddhism outside of the Dalai Lama. 19-year-old Yankain Norbu was handpicked by the Chinese government as a boy to take the place of his predecessor, who died in 1989, but some Tibetans have expressed resentment that such an important position is chosen by Beijing.
Extreme weather is causing havoc across southern Europe. At least a dozen people have been killed in storms and wildfires. Six firefighters were killed in Spain as they tried to battle flames near the country's border with Portugal. The fires have hit right across Europe, including the Greek island of Evia. There have been several blazes also across Sicily and Sardinia, in Corsica and the south of France, and along Spain's Mediterranean coast. Of course, right now, it's also peak tourist season there. Erica Wood has more.
Europe scorched by deadly wildfires, sweltering and heat waves, and battered by storms. At least 10 people have died in heavy weather across Poland, Germany and the Czech Republic. While the downpours there have now calmed, fires raging in other parts of Europe are claiming more lives and livelihoods. In western Spain, flames are engulfing forests in the mountains of Las Herdes. Locals there are scared it could have a devastating impact on the region's thriving tourism industry.
They dressed us up in mourning clothes because the little we had in the town was burnt today, and the tourists won't come here anymore.
It is a huge disaster and is very sad. The person who caused this must be a criminal, because there are no words to describe what he has done.
Criminal charges have been brought on the French island of Corsica. Three suspected arsonists have been arrested. 3 days of wildfires there have ravaged thousands of hectares of the island's forestry. More arson is suspected further south in the Mediterranean on the Italian island of Sardinia. Two people there have been killed, and fire has ripped through at least 15,000 hectares of land. And in Greece, fire authorities are on high alert as the country swelters under a heat wave, causing temperatures nearing 40 degrees Celsius.
When we're in Athens, we climb the Acropolis. It was just crazy hot. We could barely walk.
The extreme conditions could continue. The European Union is warning the fire risk will remain critical in the days ahead. Erica Wood, Al Jazeera.
never be.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM.
FreakRadio.org.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Bay State Banner has been reporting stories for the Black community in Boston for 44 years. But the Free Weekly had to stop publishing this month due to financial woes. The Banner has a reputation of holding city officials accountable to the public on a variety of issues, including development in poor neighborhoods and hiring more Black police officers. Recognizing the value of a Black-owned community newspaper, Harvard University law professor Charles J. Ogletree is putting together a group of investors to try to keep the paper alive. And Boston Mayor Thomas Menino offered the Banner a $200,000 loan that would be funded by a private nonprofit, Boston Local Development Corp. Banner publisher Mel Miller has accepted the offer. Victor Picard, senior research fellow at Free Press, cautions that the plight of the Bay State Banner is another example of a systemic crisis facing journalism around the country.
the Banner's case suggests it's more evidence for how advertising no longer adequately supports the kind of journalism that our democracy requires, and that we're dealing with the effects of a kind of market failure here. So when we're talking about this being a systemic crisis, we have to understand that this is a problem for public policy if the market is not supporting journalism.
One-time bailouts aren't going to be helpful to this systemic failure in the long run. Picard instead suggests changing tax laws to allow struggling news organizations to become low-profit, limited-liability companies, or L3Cs.
L3C is a hybrid that would allow both private investments and charitable contributions while mandating public service to local communities. So it would be an ideal approach to struggling news organizations, especially small newspapers.
Some have criticized Menino's loan offer, saying the money could compromise the Bay State Banner's impartiality during an election year. Picard says we should always be watchful when large amounts of money are given to media organizations. But
we should also point out that the influence from advertisers that fund commercial media and the corporations that often own these commercial media is no less problematic. And so really a better scenario would be to have more permanent funds devoted to public media that are beyond the reach of politics as well as market pressures.
In 2007, Verizon approached the Massachusetts legislature with a mission: to change the laws that govern how cable companies negotiate with cities and towns to offer video services. Similar so-called statewide franchising laws were enacted in more than a dozen states over the past few years as telephone companies looked for ways to break into the pay TV business. But after Massachusetts Public Access Television activists turned out hundreds of concerned residents at a public hearing on the bill, the legislation never came to a vote. 2 years later, Verizon is back with a new bill, and public access advocates are once again turning up the heat. A public hearing was held at the State House on July 22nd. Colin Rhinesmith of Cambridge Community Television, an award-winning public access center, attended the hearing. Rhinesmith explains Verizon's new bill would change the laws over local franchise negotiations in ways that could harm community media.
The current system that's been in place for the past 30 years works, and we believe that this legislation could have a real negative impact on cities and towns across Massachusetts. And in particular, we're most concerned about the threat to the cable franchising process, which would limit the negotiation period to 90 days, which would essentially make meaningful negotiations impossible.
Many of the people who testified at this week's public hearing said the negotiation process was lengthy and complex, even for cities and towns with significant resources. 90 days, they said, would not provide municipalities enough time to truly assess the needs of their communities. They were particularly concerned for smaller rural towns, which rely on volunteers to negotiate these contracts.
I think what we saw yesterday at the hearing was overwhelming opposition to the legislation. There was a packed house with public access supporters, local officials from across the state. There is a single message that this bill is bad for local communities.
To find out more about Cambridge Community Television and the Massachusetts bill, go to cctvcambridge.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Tune to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM, freakradio.org, Weekend World Review. Stay tuned now for Third Paradigm coming up after this lovely song by Walla Voodoo called Mexican Radio. Stay tuned. Third Paradigm's up next. Thanks for listening.
Hear the rhythms of the music, I buy the product and never use.
requests on the telephone. I'm on a wavelength far from home. I feel a hot wind on my shoulder. I dial it in from south of the border. I hear the talking of the DJ. Can't understand just what does he say.